You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Rowan Hissau Buchanan. Rowan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Rowan, you're in London now, and we're talking March 17th, 2021. We're I guess, that just a year into this pandemic. So before we talk about your writing and more, how has the past year affected your practice, if we can discuss that? You know, it's been so different for so many artists and writers.
That's a very good question. I think it's been a strange year, I think, as it has been for all of us. And during that time, my family has had various health scares that weren't related to the pandemic, other than the fact that I was more worried about them because they were going to hospitals during this time. And I have to say that I'm incredibly thankful that everyone seems to have made it through those health scares. And so, I feel relatively very lucky. And so, you know, I don't want to make too much of a fuss of my own feelings almost. But I think it has been a hard year. And I stopped writing for a couple of months in the beginning, and it took me a while to find my way back in.
Well, I'm glad you have found your way back in. And we're going to talk about your books, or one book in particular. But is there a project you're working on now that's a new book that's separate from what we're going to be discussing? Is there a next book or next project that you're involved in at the moment?
Yes, I am working on another book, though it is very much in the messy first draft stage, where if I try to talk to you about it, I'm sure it would make absolutely no sense. And so it's probably my favorite part in some way of writing, as well as that time where you're figuring out what your story is about and who these characters are.
So let's talk about Starling Days. I know you're going to also read a little bit from that today, but to talk about that book, which has gotten, you know, such wonderful reviews and attention, and must be very exciting for you in awards. How did that novel begin? What did that come out of, or did it come out of something specific? Because it's the characters are so evocative, and it's just a gorgeously written book. Can you tell me a little bit about the birth of that, or the context that came about in?
Of course. So, for me, I think often when I begin writing, whether it's a short story or an essay or a book, it's because there's something I don't fully understand about the world, or there's a question that I'm trying to puzzle through. And this book is about a couple, and in the beginning of the book, so this isn't a spoiler, the wife's mental health medication stops working. And what happens next is sort of the fallout from that moment and the changes that occur in that relationship. And I was very fascinated by what, you know, not to get too philosophical, but what the self means when you're going through mental health issues, when it's shifting and changing and you don't know who is the true version of yourself, which is something that character struggles with a lot. And what does it mean to love that person? There's an expression that gets tossed around on places like Instagram. You have to love yourself before you can be loved, or something, you know, along those lines. And it always stuck in my head because that seemed like such an impossible request, to be asked to love yourself when no one else could love you. But equally, I can see why it gets tossed around, because there is a grain of truth. It's very hard to be in a relationship with someone and treasure someone who is trying to destroy themselves. And so the sort of the tension of how do you work through that problem was one of the seeds that I think was rolling around in my head when I was thinking about writing this book. And sort of a little bit more detail, and part of it is just the idea of this woman whose mental health medication has been working for a long long time and then suddenly stops was based on something that happened to someone I loved very much. And although the circumstances were otherwise entirely different, I remember that I was completely unsure what to do because, maybe unwisely, but I've always looked to fiction to tell me how to live, how to be a person. And I'd read novels about, and essays and articles, from the points of view of people who thought either mental health medication was very bad for you and it dulled you and it made you not yourself, and from the point of view of people who said, no, this really, really helps me be myself. It makes me be my truest self and allows me to be the person I want to be in the world. And I'm not here to tell anyone what their perspective should be on that. But I'd never read a story about someone who had been on medication, that medication had been working for them, and then suddenly it stopped, and they had to reconsider their whole lives. And so I think that happened many, many, many years before I began to write this book, but it was something that I had always troubled me, and perhaps is why I ended up in the book.
That's so interesting, and yeah, I'd love to talk about that a little bit more, and I'm looking forward to your reading, but it's interesting that you say, you know, you look to fiction on how to live, and I've been thinking that myself lately. I read a lot of fiction, and sometimes I think I shouldn't be reading fiction. I should be reading more about, you know, Carl Jung or philosophical things on how to live, you know, that perhaps fiction, you know, is a kind of a world we enter into. But I think you're right, you know, that that is also how I perceive fiction as a, and I never thought of it that way before, but we get involved with the characters, right? We admire the characters, we don't admire the characters, and this tells us a little bit more about who we are as individuals and perhaps allows us to better know ourselves, you know, in some kind of, not necessarily, when I think of like a philosophical way of knowing, it is more like reading Carl Jung and thinking, like, what archetype am I? What do I fit into? What do my dreams mean? Who am I? You know, but fiction allows us something else, right? It gives us an example that we compare ourselves to. And what you're talking about is something that I think many people in 2020, 2021 are grappling with, which is not only their own mental health issues of their loved ones, and what it means when medication is working or not working, because this is what allows us to kind of be empathetic with somebody or merge them, but well, not merge them, but it allows us to understand ourselves more. So before you read it, just to talk a little bit more about that, you know, this book seems to have had, you know, resonated with a lot of people. It's obviously gotten a lot of attention. Do you think it's because of this issue that seems so present, this idea of who is your sort of, you know, as elusive as it is, your real self? And as you were saying, some people say when I'm, and I've heard this from friends as well, I'm thinking of one friend in particular who think, my God, when I'm on this, I'm the person I want to be. I'm the excited, you know, enthusiastic person I want to be, which seems so interesting because it's not the person they actually are without it. And so that's a little hard to kind of understand, but it seems like it's a very contemporary issue that we're all struggling with in relationships, right? Or
yeah. I mean, I agree, and I think one of it is. I don't know. I want to say that my book is the first book that I wrote about the self. I think it's in some ways that's what the novel has been doing for a very long time, because I think it does it. It's an art form that is particularly interested in interiority. I'm not going to say that there's no movie that can do that or no painting that can do that, but I think the novel, the gift of the novel is it's all about the inside of the mind, whether that mind is on medication or not, whether that mind is sick or not. And I think it for me, it felt like it lent itself particularly to that question. And I... think it's a, I think it's very interesting because, yes, there is the medication issue, but this sort of book also touches on something else that interests me, which is that she discovers she has polycystic ovaries, which some huge portion of women have, and it can, one of the side effects is depression, or is possibly depression, and so she's going, okay, but wait, is this my ovaries? And that seems like something a sexist would say. Your lady parts are moving around in you, so you're hysterical. And so to be able to go, okay, but maybe there's this separate physical reason, and I think trying to, that character is trying very hard to unpick that. And I think to go back to something you said about philosophy and essays, which are, of course, incredibly valid and useful and interesting. But I think the reason for me that reading fiction can so appeal, and sometimes writing fiction, is most good nonfiction writing has to have an argument. And it says, this is the argument, this is what I believe is the soul, is the spirit, is the self. And I think the wonderful thing about a novel is you can slip in different ideas, different arguments, different ways of seeing the world through different characters without coming down to the reader and saying, this is the right one, you have to agree with me. And the reader can make the judgments, which feels very freeing to me as a writer.
I agree. I always love, movies and fiction where the argument is left to the reader, and it's often one that's difficult, right? This was quite a few years ago, but I remember seeing that in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. You end up with this end of the movie, and you can walk out of that movie thinking this person was right, this person was wrong, or something else. And it was such a, it's so in a way liberating to not be given the argument directly, right, through the novel, but to have to choose between characters and decide for yourself. That seems, in a way, such a difficult thing for the author to do, because you know which argument that you're interested in or perhaps side with, and it seems like to withhold that, if that's the right word, takes a lot of restraint, right? Because it would be easy, or seems very human, to say, this is what I believe, this is what I think is the way forward. But to present characters that are allowing the reader to think that takes a kind of good amount of perspective on yourself and your novel. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think I would love to say that I have this vast perspective, but I think in some ways for me, this book is written from two points of view, and my first novel was also written from two points of view, that was called Harmless Like You, and I am hoping that my messy draft isn't, but I think the reason that I am drawn to multiple points of view is it allows me to have those different arguing voices, that I probably have versions of that happening in my own head all the time. The feeling, I'm sure you're familiar with it, when you can't make up your mind and you have two points of view and you go, oh, but this, but that, and being able to give those to your characters is very freeing, and you can let them fight it out without coming down the side. And I think that for me that feels in some ways more natural, whereas when I'm forced into taking one point of view, I always have a voice in my head going, but what about this? What about this? Mm. And trying to pick my own arguments apart.
I like that, yeah. So I'd love to hear, I know you're going to read from the beginning of Starling Days, is that correct?
Yes. It's not quite the very, very beginning, but it's page 2 is where I'm going to start. So you don't need to know very much from the beginning. So shall I start?
I'd love that. Yes, please.
Okay. So all you need to know is that it's late at night in New York, and Mina is standing on the George Washington Bridge. The river was as dark as poured tarmac. They said that when a body fell onto water from this height, it was like hitting the sidewalk. The Golden Gate Bridge had nets to stop jumpers. She imagined the feeling of a rope cutting into arms and legs. Your body would flop like a fish. did they have to lie there before someone scooped them out? There was nothing like that here. People said that drowning was a good death, that the tiny alveoli of the lungs filled like 1,000 water balloons. She lifted one purple flip-flop and dropped it over the river. She didn't hear it hit. The shape simply vanished into the black shadow. That was when the lights got brighter and the voice, male and certain, lobbed into her ears. "Ma'am, step away from the rail." The police car's lights flashed blue and white and red. Once she'd had an ice pop those colors, and the sugary water had pooled behind her teeth. "Ma'am, step away from the rail." "Good evening, officer. Have I done something wrong?" Mina asked. "Please get into the car," he said. There were two of them. The other was younger, and he was speaking into a radio. It was hard to make out his words over the wind and traffic. Was he talking about her? "This is a public walkway," Mina said. "It was open. I haven't done anything wrong." "Ma'am, get into the car." "I don't want to get into the car. Look, I was just getting some air. I was thinking. I'll go home now." "Ma'am, don't make me come over there." Mina had never been in a police car. She'd read once that the back doors only open from the outside. Who knew what would happen if she got into the car? The window was rolled down, and the cop stuck his head out. There was a lump on his upper lip, a pimple perhaps. "Where are your shoes?" "It's hot out," she said. "Where are your shoes?" "I don't want to tell you about my shoes," she said. "I haven't done anything wrong. I'm an American citizen." "Ma'am, where are your shoes?" She lifted up the single flip-flop she had left. "The other one broke," she said. Behind him, other cars continued into the night. Did they even notice her standing in the dark, a small woman with bare legs and feet? She was aware of the bluing bruise she'd caught banging her knee on the subway door. In the shower that morning, she'd skipped shaving her legs. In the beam of his headlamps, could he see hairs standing up in splinters? "Ma'am, I really need you to get into the car. I can't leave you here. What if something happened to you?" In his voice, she heard the insinuation that normal women, innocent women, didn't walk alone on bridges at night. "I'm fine," she said. Mina knew her stubby ponytail was frizzy. Bleaching black to Marilyn Monroe blonde had taken 4 rounds of peroxide. Now it stood up in breaking strands. If she'd conditioned it, would this cop think she was sane? If she'd blow-dried it, would he have let her go home? And of course, there were the tattoos twining up her arms. "We can talk about it in the car," he said. His shadow friend was bent over the radio, lips to the black box. Mina was tired. It was the heat, or perhaps the wind, so she got into the car. The seat was smooth. Someone must have chosen the fabric specially. This must be wipeable and disinfectable. People probably spat on this seat. They probably pissed on purpose and by mistake. Between the front and back seats was a grill. She would not be able to reach out to touch the curve of the cop's ear or straighten his blue collar. The flip-flop lay across her knees. The cops wanted to know her name, address, phone number, and social security. She gave them. "We're taking you to Mount Sinai," said the cop. "I was just going for a walk, clearing my head. I don't need to be in a hospital. I was just clearing my head." Damn, repeating herself was a habit of the guilty. Mina tried to slow her breath. "See it from my point of view," he said. "You're walking alone on the bridge at night. I can't let you out. I don't know what would happen." Only then did she understand that they must do this every night. Drive back and forth across the bridge, looking for people like her. So I guess I'll leave it there for now.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Beautiful piece of writing, of course, and thank you for reading that. And so and of course, it reflects on what we were discussing. And, you know, for me, what sticks out there visually is just the drop of the flip-flop into the water. You know, that almost gives me a sense of vertigo. It's such a wonderful and a kind of upsetting image. And really, really lovely. So this book was was written. You've got some wonderful reviews in Paris Review and others. Has it created any other conversations that you were surprised about after its release? I would think a book like this, with the attention that it's got and also its subject matter, as we discussed a little bit earlier, would generate a kind of conversation among people, as I think you and I were sort of saying, it creates a conversation among yourself, right? What do we do in these instances? Did it create any kind of conversation or responses that surprised you or that you want to mention?
Yeah. So I think it was very interesting to me and surprising to me that the people who enjoyed my first book, Harmless Like You, the most, tended to contact me publicly, so on Instagram or Twitter. You know, they would do it in the way where everyone can see. And for this book, a lot of the messages I got were in DMs or were private, and they were messages to me with people telling me their stories that they didn't necessarily want to put publicly. And, you know, these weren't people I knew most of the time. And I think it was quite, I mean, I was honored, and you sometimes don't know exactly what to say other than to be grateful that someone has seen in your work something that makes them trust you enough to be a repository of those thoughts. I think it's sort of, we have come a long, long way when it comes to stigma around mental health, and I think we are getting better about talking about it. And, you know, you'll hear people saying, oh yeah, I'll meet you for lunch, but I can't do Wednesday because on Wednesday I see my therapist, you know, and it sounds very normal. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's huge progress. But I think we're still quite scared to talk about the times when we really were the most lost or the most out of control. And those aren't things that people should have to say on Twitter. You should never have to say anything on Twitter. But I think I was surprised by both the desire of people to tell and the desire of people to keep it private sort of simultaneously. I even had one person who wrote something very sweet about it publicly and then deleted it and then messaged me, saying, I'm really sorry for deleting that. I just realized I didn't want to talk about my own mental health. And I was like, that's fine. It's absolutely fine. So I think that was very interesting to me.
It is interesting, and of course also a different kind of responsibility for you. That's not something normally a writer of fiction is shouldered with, this kind of almost confessional writing that people are sending you that sounds so tender and delicate that, as you were saying, like how to respond to that. This is reaching, you know, beyond fiction and into something where, which, you know, almost seems like there must be a word for that where people feel that they must share their story kind of thing. But then they're sharing it to you, and so what do you do with their story is really the question, right? That would seem to be, and it sounds like you handled it well, but that's the difficult thing, right? How do you respond?
Yeah, and I try my best, but you know, and I do think there's no emoji for it, sadly. but it's a strange thing about our sort of public private lives is you just sort of sometimes you wish you could have that just calm silence of being with a person the way you have with a friend when they tell you something serious, where you may not have the words or the right words, but you can just make the space to be with that person. And there are people who are wonderful at doing that online, and I think we're all having to learn how to do it better these days. But it's been a new thing for me.
Yes. Well, thanks so much for reading that and sharing this. I really, really appreciate your writing and also your reading. I want to ask you one more question, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
So I'm reading a book that I think is actually out in the U.S., but is not out in the U.K., so I'm reading a proof of it, which is a book called Build Your House Around My Body by Violet Cooper Smith. And it's set in Vietnam, and it's sort of part ghost story, part family history, and it's really fun and delightful, and also touches on some political things about what one of the main protagonists, several protagonists, one of the main protagonists is half Vietnamese, and she's sort of trying to navigate what it means to be in Vietnam. And anyway, it's a very good book, and I recommend it to anyone who can buy it.
Rowan, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time and your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.